Well, let's move on to our final case study, a patient of Dr. Webster's. This is Jim. He's 59 years old and has suffered from chronic pain for more than two decades. Now, despite being at risk for aberrant behavior, he is currently being appropriately managed with opioid therapy.
Well, we live in the mountains, and it's just a beautiful place. Right now, it's spring. It's wonderful outside.
Spencer!
We have two of the grandchildren live with us. That's probably my highlight of my day, when I come home and get to spend some time with them.
Hi, guys.
Hi. Hello. How
you doing? I served about a total of 18 years with three different fire departments. I was an apparatus operator. I'm the one who got to drive the big trucks. I used to have to be able to pick up 200 pounds and carry it. You know, there was one time where I had part of a ceiling and roof fall on me. I was about 36 years old when that happened. The MRI shows that I had three discs that were severely ruptured. I've had a total of eight surgeries. It was just the most intense pain I'd ever felt in my life. In the beginning, they prescribed me things like acetaminophen and codeine. Then we moved on to hydrocodone. I was in so much pain, I had to do something. I began taking extra doses. And then pretty soon, you're taking substantially more than what you should be taking, and that's where you are into abuse. I didn't leave the house for almost a year. It affected every part, every facet of my life. It was a terrible, terrible time. When I went to see Dr. Webster, probably 6-7 years ago, I was hunched over. I was in a great deal of pain. I had little hope and was terribly depressed. I could not imagine going through the rest of my life that way.
Hi, Jim.
Hello, how are you today?
I'm good, how are you?
Jim typifies many chronic pain patients. It is very common for patients to overuse their medicine. But we have to ask why, and not just assume that the individual is an abuser or that they're an addict. The primary reason patients will overuse their medicine is because they're trying to get better pain control.
Does that cause any pain?
No.
Jim was at high risk for abuse because of a number of factors. One, he was a smoker, but probably more significant is that he had a history of using medications more than he should have used. So we had to choose the best treatment option and then to monitor him carefully over a period of time. What seemed to work the best for Jim was to use an immediate release formulation, and that's all controlled by his wife, dispensed to him each day. It is critically important that physicians understand that individuals who have a pattern of overusing or misusing their medications can be properly treated. It is not an excuse to discharge a patient from your practice.
I haven't had any problems with drugs now for many years. They all work well. I find also one way to get rid of the pain is by physical activity. And so I'm very active. I've got hundreds of projects around here that I keep doing just to help me manage the pain and takes my mind off the pain.
The mushroom.
The medications have helped a great deal. I have a wonderful life.
Quite a guy, and he illustrates one of the reasons I'm in the profession, honestly. It's because we can make a difference. This is somebody that you can open up to and explain the problems, but also he understood the problems that he had gotten into by overusing the medicines and admitted that he had and needed some structure. And because he was very much interested in still having some pain relief but needed that structure, including his wife in the handing out of the medications, helped with that structure. He's been in my practice for many years, and he's done very well. And it's a wonderful example of what we can do for people like Jim, who are at moderate to high risk.
Yeah, and these are some of the most grateful patients I take care of because they're told they're addicts, that nobody will take care of them. They don't know where they're going to get pain relief. And I want to point out again how important the family is in this. The wife here that was taking the medicine and doling it out. And Jim may know that he has trouble with it. And if he had unlimited access, he's going to overtake the drug. So he is relegating this to somebody else, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to do. Yet you need to have the family members involved in this. You need to have a family meeting so that they're in and they understand why the medication's being given and have them be partners in this. It's not just a patient and doctor relationship frequently.
What are the pitfalls to consider when managing a patient like this, particularly patients receiving opioid therapy? Are there particular guidelines in this situation?
There are a number of guidelines that are available now. Some of them are terrific and some of them are not so terrific. The best guidelines available in the United States at this time, I believe, are the American Pain Society, American Academy of Pain Medicine guidelines. These guidelines are evidence-based, which means we get to see what the evidence is supporting our decision-making. And what we find in the care of patients treated with opioids is that most of the evidence quality is low. There's not a lot of good evidence to support the use of opioids or to warn us about the pitfalls. And so the guidelines really have to rely on expert opinion, unbiased when possible. And I think the American Pain Society, American Academy of Pain Medicine guidelines strove to be unbiased and are largely unbiased. The key points from those guidelines are risk stratification. Treatment with opioids is a trial. You need to do a risk-benefit analysis. A agreement needs to be documented, whether or not it's a written contract, opioid agreement, pain management plan, whatever you want to call it. It needs to be done. That discussion needs to be held, and that needs to be documented in the medical record. And that process can be helped a lot by the use of an opioid agreement. You need to see your patients regularly. You have to anticipate side effects that we haven't really talked about here very much. Constipation, sedation, sexual dysfunction, hypogonadism, things that may have consequences for our patients that we can sometimes treat in advance and sometimes treat later on. We need to monitor our patients. The big controversy when it comes to monitoring to this date is urine toxicology testing. And the APS-AAPM guidelines recommended urine toxicology testing in high-risk patients and recommended that it should be considered in low-risk patients. That pendulum may be swinging, and I can only express my own personal opinion. And I do urine toxicology testing now on all of the patients that I prescribe opioids to, high risk, low risk, moderate risk, because I know that I can't tell who the patients are who may be suffering from another treatable disorder is.
So once you've started the opioid therapy, what can physicians do to monitor their patients, really to sort of reach that delicate balance to make sure that the patient is being adequately treated for pain, but also minimizing the risk for any aberrant behaviors?
We need to monitor our patients for aberrant behaviors and for psychosocial crises in their lives as well. When our patients have a problem with running out of drugs every month, as Dr. Webster said, it might not be a problem if it happens once or twice. It's a time when you can educate your patient about the safe use of these drugs. But when a pattern develops, if patients have four or more aberrant behaviors, then there's a strong correlation between aberrant behaviors and the disease addiction. And so if they have lost and stolen prescriptions, if they're calling frequently for refills, if they have unauthorized increases in doses, et cetera, those are red flags. We need to monitor for those occurrences. We need to monitor their urines. It may be that a patient that is at high risk of developing a problem with addiction needs to have his urine checked monthly. And we also have to appreciate that that monitoring is not a punitive treatment method. We know from the addiction community that urine toxicology monitoring improves compliance. So we may be helping our patients by checking their urines, and also we want to know if our patients are suffering from the disease addiction so we can offer them treatment for addiction.
There are abuse deterrent opioids available to try to prevent the problem of opioid abuse. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, actually, there are several companies out there with new products that are available today and a whole host in the pipeline trying to develop
different ways to prevent people from misusing or abusing the medicine, and they're all made up a little differently, trying to attack the problem from different approaches. But you can think of many of them in two main categories, or three perhaps. One is those which have some kind of a physical barrier that's hard to manipulate, so you can't take the core chemical of the opioid out. So take, for example, you can't crush it, you can't snort it, you can't pull it up into a syringe, so you just take it whole, and that's a physical barrier. Another is where they're combining an antagonist to an opioid to neutralize the opioid if it is manipulated. So one of the common ways that opioids have been abused is to crush and to get all of the extended release formulation released immediately and then taken orally or to be snorted or to be diluted and injected. So in one of the products, the center of each bead has an antagonist we call naltrexone. And naltrexone then it can be released if it's crushed somehow so that it prevents an additional high that would be sought by somebody trying to abuse the medication. And then there's a third general category, and that would be the products that have an aversive property, so that if you take too much or take it in a route that's not intended, that is, intravenously or snorting, then the aversive product like niacin or capsaicin predominates, and it can cause a very, very significant adverse reaction. All with the intent to keep people from misusing the drug.
So what potential do abuse deterrent formulations have as a drug category to mitigate abuse?
Again, in my setting in primary care, that most common way of misusing a drug is that they just take more than we want. So instead of taking two hydrocodone products, they take four or five. If you have a medication that if you take more of, it causes an adverse event to you. So you get some capsaicin and your throat burns, your mouth burns, you take niacin so you start flushing, then that would give some behavioral feedback to the patient to not do this. Or when you do this, the increased analgesia or the feeling high isn't worth the adverse event that you get. So I think there are some properties of that that would be beneficial. The other thing I worry about is, or that I think would be great, is that when you have a medicine, I mean, how many pills after a hysterectomy, how many pills do you give? Do you give 30 pills? Do you give 10 pills? Well, you don't really know, so the doctors kind of default to giving more because they don't want to call back, and that leads to more medication in the medicine cabinet. So if the teenager is taking the medicine out of the medicine cabinet in order to do something with it, as in crush it or snort it or light it under a little Bic lighter and have it inhaled, and they can't do that because it's hard to do, then that medicine has less value. And I think for that reason, some of these medicines that aren't being adequately guarded at home will have less potential for being abused by the teenage family members, for example.
Or any family member. What type of patient should physicians consider giving these particular abuse deterrent formulations?
Well, I think that one day my hope is that all patients will only receive abuse deterrent formulations. Unfortunately, we only have three that are out now, so it's difficult to kind of make that full move, but you can't identify. The point is this: you cannot identify who is going to misuse, abuse, or has the vulnerability to addiction. You can't identify who all of those people are, even with our risk assessment. So if we're really going to have a major impact on curbing the problem of abuse and addiction and diversion, we need to provide abuse deterrent formulations, improved formulations that have abuse deterrent properties across the board. So now, if they come out and you have an option to use something, I think you have to seriously consider using these today as often as possible and encourage industry to get more of them out there so that they can compete with each other and that we have only abuse deterrent formulations available.
I completely agree with what Dr. Webster just said. He's talking about universal precautions in pain medicine, the fact that we don't know who the patient is who has HIV, and so we have to be careful of every needle stick. And the fact is, we don't know which patient is going to be misusing, abusing, our opioids. And so we have to be prepared to anticipate that any of our patients might be abusing or become addicted to these drugs. I completely agree that once a variety of these drugs are on the market, I am going to switch to all abuse deterrent formulations for all of my patients.
Well, do you think that these newer agents will also help to reduce the amount of aberrant behavior in the long run?
That's a really good question. I think that if we can correlate aberrant behavior with patients who suffer from the disease addiction, which we probably can, then I think it will be easier for us to identify patients who suffer from the disease addiction using these drugs.
I don't think that there's any doubt that aberrant behavior is going to be curbed, because if you're going to have any impact on the disease of addiction or abuse, you are curbing aberrant behaviors. Now, is it going to eliminate it? No. And there's nothing that I can see in the horizon that's going to eliminate aberrant behaviors. I tried to do that with my kids growing up, but it didn't work. So, you know, we just, that's unrealistic. That's kind of our expectation, that we have to realize we can't make it foolproof. There is no foolproof solution. But we can make a major, I think, dent on the abuse problem if we had better formulations, and many of them abuse deterrent.
Well, gentlemen, this has certainly been a robust conversation. What would you say are the key take-home points for your colleagues in regards to managing pain with opioid therapy?
I think if you look at this whole program in its entirety, you could come away believing that you don't have the skills, the expertise, the knowledge, the time, the backup in your office as far as help in your office to be able to manage patients with chronic pain on an opioid regimen. You easily could make that determination from a primary care point of view, and I would implore you not to make that determination. Most of our patients are taking pain medicines appropriately. Most of our patients are reluctant to take pain medicines and are getting a tremendous benefit from functional improvements with opioids. There are some patients that maybe we need pain experts. We need to identify them, but certainly we have the skills. Primary care does. We've shown this in a variety of other chronic illnesses that we can do this. We can do it in chronic pain. And if we are going to make a dent in America of this epidemic of undermanaged pain, it has to come from primary care, and we have to step up to the plate and take on this new task in our lives.
I'd only like to say that these are wonderful drugs. These are the most potent pain relievers and the most effective pain relievers we have. They have risks. We should not be afraid of using them. We need to make sure that these drugs are available to help our patients. And if it requires a little bit of extra work on the part of doctors, nurses, PAs, in order to become skilled at using these drugs, then it's well worth it to relieve the suffering of our patients.
Since the risk is real and very serious, and we cannot identify who is really at greatest risk, we need to consider using the abuse deterrent formulations for all patients when they become available, and not just target individuals they think may be at high risk.
Thank you all for participating in this important conversation. And we'd also like to thank you, our viewers, and we hope today's program will be helpful in advising you on managing pain with opioid therapy. We also encourage each of you to go to your computer, log on to discoverychannelcme.com, and take the post test. It only takes a few minutes to earn free credit for the program. If you'd like to see this program again, you can watch it online, download a podcast, or order a DVD. All the graphics and references from the program are also available online. Finally, we'd like to thank Integrity Continuing Education for serving as our educational partner and the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine for accrediting the program. We'd also like to thank King Pharmaceuticals for providing the educational grant to make this program possible. I'm Rhea Blakey. Have a great day.